All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. I have to apologize for the poor sound quality, guys, for this intro. I had to record in my office today, and the air handler cannot be silenced. So this is Chapter 4, Supplemental Episode 5, and today we're going to be talking to Kevin O'Connor, co-founder of the granddaddy of all internet advertising companies, DoubleClick. Chances are, if you've seen a banner ad over the last decade or so, it was served up behind the scenes by DoubleClick's Dart technology. Now the backbone of Google's banner ad inventory, DoubleClick was one of the first advertising companies formed, one of the largest of the dot-com era, and as we'll discuss in this interview, DoubleClick is really the godfather of the New York City Silicon Alley tech scene. So, here is Kevin O'Connor. Kevin O'Connor, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in the Detroit area and you went to the University of Michigan, is that correct?
I did.
Electrical engineering was your degree?
It was electrical engineering. I didn't have much computer science back then and thought I'd be interested in hardware. I was wrong.
And you, you immediately... took the entrepreneurial route. You started a company right out of college, right?
Right during college. So I was going to go get my PhD. That was my dream. And the day I got accepted into the PhD program at Michigan, I decided to go start a company with a buddy that I interned with. It was the PC had just come out, and everyone was dropping out of college, it seemed like, to pursue the PC. Thought it'd be something big.
And what was the name of the company?
Intercomputer Communications Corp.
And what did it do?
We tied we tied PCs into mainframes, Burroughs and Sperry and DEC and Wang. We did a whole bunch of terminal emulators.
And that was successful enough. Did you get bought out or did it go public eventually?
Yeah, we ended up selling it to a company called DCA. Kind of ironic, a little known story is that, you know, we saw what was happening to the mainframe industry was declining. The PC industry was booming and the mainframes are declining. And we were like trying to figure out what the hell do we do? And so I'd come up with this product idea. It was called OOT, Object Oriented Terminal. And the goal was to create use the brains of the PC, have a single, what the world needed wasn't 10 different terminal emulators, it needed just one terminal. TCP/IP. So we basically kind of invented the web, but didn't think it was a good idea, and we dropped it because we thought the world doesn't need another terminal emulator. So we were so close.
That's interesting.
Blew it, but it was OOT, Object Oriented Terminal.
So when you first encountered the web, was it sort of like, we should have gone in that direction?
Yeah. It was like, oops, could have had that 5 years earlier. But it wouldn't have probably, you know, there was obviously lots of other stuff had to happen. So,
So tell me about the encountering the internet, or the web, I suppose. This is after you've sold to DCA. So are you looking for a new project to start?
Yeah. So I was a pretty early adopter of TCP/IP, which was the foundation of the internet.
Right.
So really saw that as kind of, you know, everything else was sort of slow communications. And then I remember first seeing, I was running a research group at DCA, and we saw, I remember the first time I saw the internet, 2400 baud or 9600 baud, and I just wasn't that impressed. And then just kind of went away and started looking at other stuff. And all of a sudden, we finally got a T1, convinced the company to put a T1 in, and it was like, wow, this is a big idea.
So
and that's probably 1993, 94, maybe.
Right. So how soon do you start to get the itch to try to do a company related to web and internet stuff again?
Well, we ended up merging with another company called Attachmade, and the main owner, CEO, made my decision real easy. He said he didn't believe in research. So I quit a few days after the merger, and then really started looking at internet really looking at new product ideas. And it wasn't completely focused on 100% on the internet. Thought that would be an interesting area, but really kept coming around back to the internet. I mean, one thing I've learned in, you know, sort of PCs and networking is that, big new technologies cause disjoints, and that's a perfect time to start a company. So I became increasingly convinced that disruption in every aspect of the economy. Didn't realize it was that big. I remember our first original business plan, you know, showed, I think, a total of 1 million users connected. Over, I don't know, five-year period.
What year was that business plan?
1995.
Right. So how do you settle on the idea that advertising is your way in? Is it obvious that the internet itself is going to need a business plan, a way to make money, and this is the most obvious way to do it?
Yeah, so we were pursuing ideas. Dwight Merriman and I were brainstorming, but slightly before that, I stumbled upon this 20-year-old kid who had also dropped out of college, Georgia Tech, was living with his grandmother, and some lawyer connected us and said, this kid has his product, doesn't know what to do. And it was Internet Security Systems, Chris Klaus. And I found this, he had come up with this scanner, this kind of hacking tool for the good guys. And he had sold it to 10 Fortune 500 companies for 10 grand each. And it was just a brilliant, really recognizing that as people connected to the internet, that virtually every computer system was horribly exposed. And so that turned out to be a really, really good company, but I really wanted to do something of my own. So we, Dwight and I were really focused on, okay, it's like planning a city from scratch. You know, what does a city need? You know, they need plumbing and sewage and electricity. So we're trying to figure out, you know, what was for the early days of the internet, what's going to be essential? And then it came back to economics, how people going to make money, right? There was no, it was all government subsidized, and how it was going to unleash. So we took a look at sort of what was CompuServe doing and AOL, how did those things kind of go? Originally, we thought it was going to be the CompuServe model, which was, you know, you buy a subscription and you have one subscription and gives you rights to access sites, and the sites would share a part of that subscription. But the more we dug into it, I mean, we were really pursuing that idea. And, Dwight, one time we kind of concluded, well, subscription maybe, but not really sure. And Dwight goes, well, why don't we do a network rather than a network for subscriptions? Let's do a network for ads. And I remember walking up to my, we've been down in my basement probably 3 months. Walking up, it was very much an epiphany, as Steve Blank would put it. Welcome to my wife, you know, I got a job. The search is over. We're starting. We didn't know what to call it. Our first name was terrible, by the way. It was Internet Advertising Federation.
Mm.
Very Star Trek-y.
Did either of you have any background in advertising at all?
Zero.
That's incredible. So, are you taking a technology angle at it first? Like, you're going to come up with the software and then to serve the ads, and then you're going to market that?
So Dwight is you may know Dwight now from, well, he was partner at DoubleClick, but he also went to do MongoDB, and a brilliant engineer. And I was a software engineer. I'd programmed for 10 years, but it was no longer developing. So the kind of the split was, okay, Dwight, you're going to do the technology. I got to go figure out what the hell advertising and direct response is. So I bought two books, kind of the definitive books on advertising. And then I bought, I don't remember what book that was, but then I bought Nash's book, which was a sort of the Bible of direct marketing. I was reading through it. I'm looking at the, and I was like, we can do this. We can do all this, you know, reach and frequency and targeting and measuring response rates. Like, we could do all this stuff. You know, we can take this theory that most people have forgotten in the advertising market and make it real on the internet. So really quickly realized that that was going to be our competitive advantage, the TV and print and everything else.
So that's your original insight, is that almost the internet can sort of make good on the promise of advertising, because it, you know, advertising famously, half of it doesn't work. You just don't know which half, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there was two parts. One is we looked at all the other traditional medias that had followed before. They were all advertising dominated, right? So years later, I'm a Glazer from Real Networks. So the difference between, you know, selling something for a nickel and give it away for free is about 10 million users. So users will always pick free over paid. So we figured that was going to be the backbone of the market. But we, you know, we were really trying to figure out, you know, was the internet going to be this highly fragmented? Because remember, AOL, you knew, is the precursor for the internet as well as CompuServe. Mm-hmm. You know, was it going to be these walled gardens, or was it going to be completely where infrastructure was completely disconnected from content? And our belief was that it was going to be content and infrastructure were going to be completely separate.
So what was the first product you guys developed? Is it the dynamic ad targeting software? What was the thing that you roll out with and raise the money with?
Yeah, so I mean, it was the company really never had changed. It was Dart, dynamic. I can't remember if we came up with the name first and then came up with the acronym. I forget what we did, but I think we came up with Dart because it was like targeted advertising, right? To your point, we wanted to get rid of the waste, and then we called it, you know, dynamic advertising reporting and targeting or something like that. So that was the basic concept, that the internet was going to be hugely fragmented. There was all going to be all these pockets of audiences. You know, if you really want to control reach and frequency, you'd have to have a single system to control it across thousands of websites. So that was pretty much it. I remember we were running this system down in my basement. And I went down there, I don't know, it was 2 or 3, I couldn't sleep. I just remember watching it delivering ads, and the cash register was ringing. It wasn't ringing too loud back then, but I was like, wow, it was one of the first sort of SaaS applications before that was even a word. But I was like, wow, you know, we're not doing anything. This thing's making money. Love it.
Was there any sort of doubt that you had to overcome, either among clients that you sign up or anybody really, that advertising can work and can pay on the internet?
So there's always, I never had any doubt that the internet was going to be big, right? I mean, the concept of world's information to anybody at any time for free, I mean, that's a huge concept. How could that not be successful? I knew that advertising in some method would work. The question was, and that whatever it was going to find its mark, you know, it's a price, true price. The question for us, and we were really singularly focused on this, which was, look, our competition is not the internet. We're not competing against, I mean, there really was no one else out there selling ads. There was a few people, but that's not the competition. Our competition is TV and radio. What we've got to focus on is proving that advertising works on the internet, and once we prove that it works, especially on the direct response side, then it's like, you know, it's printing money. It's people are gonna buy it all day long. The branding side was a much, much more difficult challenge for us, because, you know, how do you prove branding works?
Who are some of the initial clients? Is it just people dipping their toes in the water to test out this internet thing? Or, because I had read at some point that, you know, your Netscape is an early client and you're delivering at one point 10% of their revenue. So they obviously knew, well, actually they didn't know, otherwise they would have been a portal sooner. But who were the people that you originally signed up with?
So the the original. So what happened is that there was four of us in my basement in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And we're building the technology, and I was always going into the library, back when you went to the library, and picking up Ad Age and Ad Age and Ad World or whatever. And so I'm reading it. And I'm always looking for a sort of competition, and all of a sudden I see this story about this company called DoubleClick, and it was Dave Karlick. He's going on how he's going to build this network, and we had not announced yet. This is all sort of complete hush hush. And he's going to build this network and link it up through technology. And it was what we were planning on doing too. And I'm like, holy crap! You know, this guy's beat us to the punch. So I decided to reach out to Dave Karlick. Was working at a Poppy Tyson, which was owned by BJ Caney, a big ad agency holding company. So I call him up and say, you know, hey, you know, we're actually doing the same thing. He said, really? And I go, yeah, you know, we're building the technology. He goes, that's great, because we don't have any technology. And I'm saying, well, what are you talking about? You announced your product. You said, oh, that was just total, you know, kind of bullshit. I was just announcing the concept. We have no technology. Those guys were actually selling Netscape and Excite's inventory. So these guys were, it was only four people, right? So mm-hmm. they had four people that were selling the early days of advertising, that by far the most experience. And we're selling a lot of it. And we decided to merge, big mega merger of our four people, their four people. So that's how, and then, you know, the choice then, our name was Internet Advertising Network, and they were called DoubleClick. And DoubleClick was clearly a better name. So we ended up merging the company, so this was an interesting, kind of interesting historically, just looking at, we knew Atlanta probably wasn't where we wanted to stay. We were technologists, and the choice was either move to New York or move to Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, obviously the home of technology, but we felt we had the technology covered. That wasn't our problem. It really was the, you know, move to where your customers are. And at the time, I mean, New York controlled publishing and advertising, you know, 75% of the market. So let's go to New York. And so then we took on the DoubleClick moniker. So at the time that we were selling Excite and Netscape, so my big push was, okay, look, we want you guys to move on to the DoubleClick network, our technology. Because at the time, we couldn't deliver reports to anybody. We couldn't deliver anything. People would give us, you know, $100,000, $1 million, and they just had to believe and trust that we were delivering it. And we never knew whether they were delivering it. So it was a pretty ugly situation. I think we were probably $20 million in revenue, and they basically, we either resigned the accounts or they fired us because they wouldn't move over to the network. They wouldn't use our technology. And Netscape at the time, we were basically all of Netscape's profits, but something they never really sort of talked about or acknowledged. And they're, you know, quite honestly, I think they're a little bit, I'd say they were a little bit ashamed of advertising. I think there was only one guy working on it at the company. And then Excite decided to go in-house over time. So it was pretty tough. You know, we didn't think there was much value in just repping other people's site. We really needed the technology to deliver on the promise.
So did you guys spin out of Poppy Tyson at some point after that?
Yeah. So we were a separate company. So when we merged, we formed DoubleClick Inc. They owned, I think like 55% of us, which was a problem because all the other ad agencies saw that as kind of a conflict of interest. So we convinced and they were actually a really great partner. I discovered that we could write checks on BJ K&E, and they would cash them. I basically sort of infinite money to spend. That's had some loose controls over there. So we actually got a lot of money for free. So that was pretty nice. They're great partners, and they ended up distributing. They saw that the problem that they had, and they ended up distributing their shares to all their shareholders, and so that we were completely independent. But they were trying to sell us. So, you know, at the time, you know, here's an agency. They've got this little experiment going on, and then all of a sudden the internet takes off. I mean, people are just throwing money at everything. So they started shopping us around, and we were about a day away from merging with Yahoo. They had offered us, I think, $95 million. And I remember the date. I want to say it's 97. it offers $95 million. We wanted $100 million. And I don't know, talks fell apart. And they really wanted to sell us bad. And so I kind of on the side went and talked to Bain Capital and Greylock to see if we could buy ourselves out from them. And that's what we ended up doing, buying ourselves out from those guys.
So you specifically don't have a Madison Avenue background. What was it like? How did Madison Avenue react to the coming of the web and the internet and to you guys? I'm assuming that you guys are, you know, taking a new scientific approach to the advertising stuff. What were your relationships like with traditional Madison Avenue people?
So, yeah, in the beginning, it's really, really rough. It's like, why do I want to use the internet? No one's using the internet. I've never heard of the internet. You know, go away. But there was pockets. You know, there was internet companies. Internet companies were getting funded, so they had some money, so they knew the power of it. But a real big coup for us is we end up hiring Wendell Millard. Wendell Millard knows everyone. She came from the publishing. She came from the advertising sales side, so she knew the traditional media. And she was really great at bridging that gap. And I think the big thing that we did is the terms we use were the terms that they're familiar with. All the Silicon Valley companies were making up new terms. They're making up, you know, they weren't using reach and frequency and CPM. They were just making up stuff, right? What we did is we couched everything in terms that they knew. And then, you know, we really offered ourselves a sort of education. So at one point, no one wanted to talk to us. And then at another point, everyone wanted to talk to us because their clients were saying, hey, this internet thing looks huge. Why aren't we on it? What do you guys know about it? You know, why haven't you recommended anything to us? So we really put ourselves out there as, hey, let us help educate you guys. You know, we're not selling you. Let's just show you how it all works. And so we spent a lot of time educating agencies, their clients, and how all the system works, as well as publishers.
I'm glad you brought up things like CPM and stuff like that. I've been asking everybody that I've been talking to in advertising really basic stuff like, do you remember how the forms came to be? Like, okay, we've decided that a banner is going to be these dimensions, and a page should have only a certain amount of ads, or an ad should only be shown to a certain person two or three times before there's diminishing returns. Do you remember, were those things sort of felt out and decided upon sort of ad hoc, or was there any kind of science behind that?
So yes and no. So the one thing what we felt the most important thing in moving out this is there had to be standards within the industry. So we stole a play out of the Microsoft book, which was we'll just establish the standard, or we'll get a couple of other big players together and we'll just say, look, this is the new standard and roll it out. So we did that. We said, look, the banner, that's the new standard. There was no scientific anything about that. It was just seemed like a, you know, from the number of pixels it took on the page, it was, you know, kind of equivalent to print advertising. Then the next one is that there actually was a lot of theory and reach and frequency. And, you know, they talked a lot about frequency. And then we did sort of one of the first definitive studies on frequency, the effect of frequency on click-through rates. That was pretty easy to do. And, you know, we were able to prove sort of diminishing returns after three exposures, which matched up pretty well with sort of what traditional media had found. And so, you know, we just kept doing more and more proof points and, you know, standardization. You know, agencies didn't want, you know, literally there must have been 50 different creative types. And yeah, people thought that was great, but that's not the way agencies work. Agencies want to develop one creative and then blow it out, get maximum. They want to spend their money on reach and frequency, not on creative.
And when you're coming up with things like CPM rates, are you guessing there as well, or are you just copying maybe what was already in the print, the print CPM rates and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that. So probably the biggest breakthrough that DoubleClick had was that, you know, we approached this as a yield optimization, right? We had three parties dissatisfied. We had publishers wanted maximum revenue. Advertisers wanted maximum effectiveness, so lowest cost per whatever, per action. And then consumers wanted something that was, you know, sort of relative to them. We're always trying to predict what would somebody react to. And so we came to the very quick conclusion. We stole this from the American Airlines, who really, I forget the guy that did it. It was the same guy that did the frequent flyer, but he'd come up with sort of the yield management that when a plane leaves with an empty seat, you know, that was a wasted opportunity. So one of the things that we did is we really quickly segmented inventory. Every space that was unsold was I'm forgetting the word, but you know, it's like rotten food. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our goal was every space should be sold. So we started from the bottom up. We would go out and you want to buy lots of advertising without commit, you know, without, you may not get it, right? It may be, you may not know where it's going, or you may get bumped out, but it's very opportunistic. You know, you can buy it for a buck. And then we would sell out the premium spaces, the premium spots, you know, highly targeted inventory, you know, at the top dollar. Mm-hmm. And then kind of keep segmenting the inventory and selling it to the highest buyer. I mean, a lot of it was based on sort of print.
There were always those rumors that you would hear over the years that, you know, something like 90% of the inventory is unsold and you're just, you know, throwing ads up there for free. Were you able to, was it a case of you were effectively targeting certain specific things and so those were highly profitable and then, you know, just the vast unwashed other 90% was just anything you could serve up?
Yeah, I mean, look, we love, you know, for us, there was a buyer for everything. And with direct marketing companies, we loved them. They were great because they would take all the inventory we give them as long as it worked. So we were really focused on performance. So, you know, when you get rid of that unsold inventory, when everything is sold, you know, people have to pay up in order to get it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we looked at this very much, again, as yield management. There should be zero unsold inventory. You know, find that market. Put restrictions on everything, right? It's like, you know, look, you can't be a business traveler and show up at the airport and get on the plane. They don't allow that. But it was all sort of figuring out people will pay a premium for placement. People pay a premium for frequency and reach. They'll pay a premium for select target audiences. So it's really, you know, the more control you want it, the higher you're going to pay. And then, you know, as soon as at some point, you're right, the market became so competitive, there's so much money in the internet that people were, it really stopped working. People were paying too much for inventory. They were paying way too much. And then the dot-com crash came along and you're back to lots of available inventory.
Right. Sort of related to that question then, I've asked everybody what the click-through rates were like early on, and everyone said that early on they were what we would think would be phenomenal today because it was a new thing. People hadn't seen ads on the internet before. Do you remember what the click-through rates were like initially and did they go down over time and normalize?
Oh yeah. I mean, there were, you know, I think there was click-through rates probably, you know, 5%, 10% wasn't atypical. You know, there's probably 3% might've been the average. And then, you know, it kept declining to 1% and people are very focused on click-through rate. So click-through, there was a lot of click-through rate arbitrage. I remember I used to tell people, look, if you want clickers, target Indonesia. You know, they were like 15% click-through rates. They just love clicking on ads. But so it didn't really mean much. For us, the big sort of definitive study that we did is we were able to prove that branding worked online, that you literally could influence. And this was tying, I remember the study exactly, but we did it with a company that had linked it to offline purchase behavior. And we were able to show that, you know, you could influence offline purchases through branding. And the internet was real funky, and it still is today, you know, is it branding or direct response, or is it both? It's both.
So switching just a bit, you know, DoubleClick grew really, really rapidly and became wildly successful, sort of, you know, as the internet is blowing up as well. You know, at some point in the late 90s, you've got a company that's got locations all over the world and thousands of people, right? What was it like for you to be right? You had already had an earlier company that was successful, but was the dot-com mania and DoubleClick's growth different than what you had experienced before?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, the internet was different than what anyone had experienced before. I mean, it was insanity. I was actually probably one of the older CEOs at the time. I think, you know, when we started the company, I was 32 or something. And by then, what would I have been, like 36 or 37, sort of in the later days. And I mean, one thing that our company was very focused on was, like, I never really bought into this whole new economy thing. It's the same economy. It's just, it's more efficient. So this whole concept of giving away products and services, and it just became kind of a joke. You know, the public, ironically, the public markets, the consumers were subsidizing all this stuff. So, you know, I pretty much knew the day of reckoning was going to come. For me, it was, I remember going through the airport, and I think every publication had, you know, someone from the internet on the cover. And I think I just shown up in the W magazine, you know, 50 most people, interesting people to have lunch with. I'm like, this is not a good sign. It really reminded me of the story of, I'm going to forget the name. Back, you know, right before the crash, the guy was getting his shoe shined by the guy, and he asked for a stock tip, and broke, what the hell was his name? But he went out and sold all the stocks. And he said, look, when the shoe shine guy is investing in the market, then it's time to sell.
It wasn't Blodgett, was it?
No. 1928.
Right. Okay.
It was that kind of, like, where this industry is, this isn't real. We know when people become, we all of a sudden, the internet people were like the pop stars. That's pretty sad.
Well,
I should say sad, but, you know, it just wasn't realistic.
But at the same time, you know, specifically with things like let's say IPO madness. I mean, you know, at some point you're going to IPO because everyone's doing it, and why not? And if you don't do it, your competitors are going to have raised all this money that you won't have. And you guys got into the doing a lot of acquisitions and things like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were very you know, raising money, get big quick. That was the big thing. You know, if you had the money, you had the market capitalization, you know, you had the infrastructure, you know, you were going to be in the, it was a land grab that, you know, no one's ever seen before. So we were, and it was interesting at the time too. We were all delusional in the sense. And I remember somebody told me, I was talking to someone about acquiring a company, and I couldn't understand the valuations. It was Grant Gregory. I was on our board. He's like, Kevin, let me put it this way. It's like trading two $10,000 cats for your $20,000 dog. You know, it has nothing to do. It is all relative valuations. And I think we all fell into that trap, which is, I remember at the time we were at a, $15 billion valuation. And there was this piece of crap company from CMGI. I can't remember. Engage, I think it was. I shouldn't say, sorry, it wasn't a piece of crap, but it was a very small player, you know, big story, very small player, but it had like a $25 billion market cap. And so we were just, you know, this is just ridiculous. We're worth so much more than that. And what a lot of people forgot to say is like, well, maybe none of us are worth, you know, maybe nobody was worth that much.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Well, because you guys are sort of right there on the ground with the advertisers, and I'm sure at some point other dot-coms are you know, a large percentage of your clients, were you guys able to see when things were starting to go south sooner than everybody else did?
Yeah, I didn't. I wish I had known Warren Buffett adage on this, that the first sign of an economy is slowing ad sales. If I would have known that, you know, we would have done a lot better. No, we saw, you know, advertising is the canary in the coal mine. You were able to see, you know, right, because it's one thing you can cut, you don't have to fire anybody. So people were just cutting back in ad budgets, and then all of a sudden, you know, ad budgets disappeared. 75% of our customers went out of business.
But so
it was pretty brutal.
But you guys are still, you know, even after the bust, you guys are still a viable company that I'm assuming, you know, I'm sure you had your share of layoffs and things like that, but what are you guys looking like after the bust? There's still people that want to put ads on the web, right?
Yeah, so there was sort of two things happening. You know, Jeff Epstein was our CFO, and he taught me a brilliant lesson, which was, I was like, Jeff, why the hell are we raising money? I understand. He was doing some convertible preferred, and he said, Kevin, when people want to give you money, get money. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. And I was like, you know, I'd been through a couple of recessions and bumps. I was like, yeah, you're right. So we literally had done our secondary. I think we raised something like $400 million. We literally did that, I don't know, weeks, maybe, a couple months, I don't forget what it was, but right before the market shut down. And the market was already declining. I remember we priced it at, I forget what it was, maybe it was $100. And by the time, you know, we went to actual, for the secondary, it was probably down to like 70. And people were like, well, you're going to pull it, right? And Jeff's like, no, you know, that's crazy. You know, we should go through with it. So we raised a bunch of money. We were really financially sound. But we also knew that, look, we didn't know what was happening, what was going to happen, right? When 75% of your customers, you don't know how far it's going to go down. So we probably overcut. I mean, we cut back probably 40%, and really focused on our most profitable businesses. We had some very profitable businesses, so that helped. So that was rough. You know, and a lot of those people end up going on to Google and Facebook. So, it worked out pretty well for everybody. But, you know, I think what most companies, the mistake they made is that they were delusional. Oh, it's not going to be that bad. We'll cut 5%. And then it's like, holy crap, it's worse than we thought. But it's not gonna be that bad. So we'll cut 15%. And then, you know, pretty soon they're out of business. And our mantra all really through the whole life of the business was, we're in business to stay in business. And sorry, but we've got to right size. You know, we've got to get rid of real estate. We're going to cut back and get ourselves where we're profitable. And then we can go from there. You know, let's see where it all settles out. So was it a mistake? You know, probably cut too much. But we made it through.
Yeah, and actually, how quickly did things sort of rebound? Because I remember from that time, I always used to base it on the quality of engineer that I could hire for really, really cheap. And, you know, in 2001, 2002, you could hire insanely talented people because everybody was out of work. How quickly did stuff bounce back for you guys in terms of the advertising industry in general?
I mean, really didn't. It was a tough... You know, we ended up selling the company in 2005, and at the time, it still was not clear. You know, and things had kind of settled out, but it wasn't clear whether how long it was going to take to get back to growth. I mean, the problem with us is we were not growing. as much as we needed to. And we needed to restructure. We had too much money on the balance sheet. We had all sorts of problems that was going to be tough to handle in the public market. But it wasn't clear that they were very interesting businesses, but it wasn't clear it was going to be huge. Ironically, 3 years later, 2008, it just became a rampage. Everyone, you know, within a 6 month period, you know, everyone had bought these advertising networks. You know, Google felt that, you know, they needed, you know, DART was necessary to control advertising. Microsoft was left at the altar. You know, I wasn't part of it at the time, so I'm not sure all the inside story. So they ended up buying Aquantive, you know, which ended up writing off the entire thing. I mean, all the other companies, I think, have been written off. But, you know, DoubleClick actually went on, and it's a big part of – it's a multi-billion-dollar business for Google, which is great.
Right. Just so the listener's clear, in 2008, I think it was, Google bought DoubleClick, right?
Yes, from the Hellman Friedman, who had bought it in 2005. They made a killing. They absolutely destroyed it for their limited partners. Unfortunately, I was not part of it.
When did you actually leave DoubleClick?
2005.
So I have a couple of sort of looking back in hindsight sort of questions. You guys famously ran into controversy around issues of privacy and ad targeting really kind of early on. And my question is, you know, considering how sophisticated advertising on the web is today, and considering, I guess, maybe even the state of privacy in general in our current society, online and off, I guess, what do you think about those controversies now looking back? Were they overblown, maybe?
You know, well, I've had a lot of time to reflect on it. And, you know, it was probably the most trying time personally for me. You know, all of a sudden, you know, we became from one story in USA Today, in a matter, I probably had, you know, 1,000 stories. Bill Clinton was going to talk about it as a little known story. He was going to talk about it and mention DoubleClick in his State of the Union, and we were fortunately able to get that pull from a senator, was able to get that taken away. You know, it was an overblown issue, but it was a legitimate issue. A lot of the problem was, you know, when we stepped back and looked at it, there was no rules. You know, it was like playing pickup football, and, you know, everyone's arguing about what the rules are. What's the goal line? What's the first down? You know, and so, you know, we stepped back and said, look, let's put together industry rules. We'll talk. You know, we'll do that in conjunction with sort of government, as well as privacy. You know, reasonable privacy groups. It would come up with a set of standards so people know what the rules are and that there's no surprise. And that was the right thing to do. Ironically, at the time, you know, we were testing something what we call Boomerang. We had kind of invented this thing where you we thought that the biggest predictor of advertising was going to be purchase intent. So we came up with this idea, like, let's cookie someone on I think Victoria's Secrets was actually our first test for people who were interested. You know, you've spent all this money getting them to your site, and then you lose them because they're anonymous, and let's retarget them. And so that was the whole retargeting thing. And the results were off the chart. I mean, from a direct response side, it was something like 1,200% lift. It was so off the chart. And it was like discovering cold fusion. We were so excited. This is going to be a $1 billion idea. And then the privacy thing hit, right? And then the retargeting kind of died for a long time. And now it's a huge part of the, I don't know how big it is, but it's a big part of the advertising industry.
Well, and look at Facebook's stock price.
Yeah. So I think, you know, look, our view was, we learned, you know, when I learned everything, is that three things that people really care about, which is, well, one, people don't want data to be used against them. And that, I think, there was a big misperception. The fact is that targeted ads work. They work better. It's better for the consumer. People want it. But you got to give them a choice. So when you give them the choice, you know, like we invented the first sort of global opt-out, right? We were getting so much heat. You would think that, my God, this is like all the major, you know, it was everywhere. So we said, look, you can come and opt out anytime you want. We had like 10 people a day. But those 10 people were the loudest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we learned, look, you got to give these guys a thing to opt out. But, you know, it's an interest, you know, privacy and everything. It's an interesting thing. If you don't use it against people, and you make it better for them, then they're fine. But there's legitimate concerns. I'm not throwing NSA or any of that stuff. So,
I wonder if it's also maybe just like a classic case of it was slightly ahead of its time. You know, when I go to a website now and it shows up every day for the next month on my, you know, Facebook timeline, I kind of don't care anymore because Facebook's already sort of trained me not to care about that stuff anymore.
I mean, now I think it's so prevalent. I think where people get freaked out is when people start using, you know, there's three things that people don't want you to know about. They don't want health, financial, and, you know, sexual things. And I think, you know, the mistake that we made, we were going to merge what was formerly anonymous information on the web and make it merge it with offline, make it non-anonymous. And that was a big, you know, when we went through setting the guidelines for the internet, we said, look, okay, we can't do that without, we can't make that connection without the user knowing it, without the user's consent. Now, I believe people are doing that today. I think it's kind of I think there's big problems on the internet. I think it's a wild west. It's so complicated. I think people are, you know, stealing data. People are merging data inappropriately. No one really knows what's going on.
What do you think of advertising as it's evolved today? I mean, you know, surely the complexity of, like you're talking about, the amount of data that people are collecting, the sophistication of, you know, the algorithms and the analytics and the data that marketers can, you know, chop into pieces and things like that. It has to be orders of magnitude different than what you guys were doing, say, in 1996 or 97, right?
Yes. So, I mean, look, I think most of the really useful data that people are figuring out is purchase intent. It's, I mean, one of the reasons we started Find the Best, you know, I know how tough it is to be a publisher seeing on the other side at DoubleClick, is that, you know, Find the Best, we're really just focused on purchase intent. And, you know, it works. It works extremely well. When consumers are looking for, let's say, a car, a truck to buy, they want to see ads that have to do with the trucks that they're looking at. You know, maybe there's a $1,500 rebate, you know, at the local, you know, Nissan. You know, that's all very positive.
The sort of a final looking back question, you know, I'm New York based and I think that, you know, for the whole Silicon Alley, whatever that scene was, but even more so for the New York tech scene today, I feel like DoubleClick was really sort of a really foundational company. Like there's so many people, you know, over the years that I've run into that got their start at DoubleClick. So many companies were started by people that were at DoubleClick. Talk a little bit about, I mean, maybe even just specifically for the New York tech scene, like maybe DoubleClick's legacy in terms of making New York part of the tech scene.
So, you know, for us, you know, just an interesting story about that. I mean, we always used to get asked when the internet was kind of booming, people would come and do interviews and all over the world. They would say, you know, where is the Silicon Alley? And we're all like scratching our head going, hell if I know, there is no Silicon Alley. And our guy, head of marketing, Lee Nadler, said, you know what? Silicon Alley is right here on the corner. And I don't even remember he put up that big sign that said, welcome to Silicon Alley.
Right on the back of the Flatiron building, right?
Yes. And it was brilliant. I mean, that was like one of my favorite marketing stories. And so that got in, you know, everyone would say, here it is. It's we're Silicon Alley. They're taking pictures of it. You know, it was kind of cool. So one of the reasons I think DoubleClick, you know, look, our the way we approached business at DoubleClick was, I think somewhat unique. You know, most people focus on sort of profits and revenue. We focused on solving problems. You know, what would, you know, to me, the purpose of any business is solve a big problem better than anyone else. And we were relentless at that. Well, we did strategic planning. We spent almost all of our time on innovating. Like, what, forget about, you know, hey, our strategic plan is to grow profits by 15% a year and, you know, double our revenue. We never even talked about that. That was never part of our strategy. Our strategy was always, what big problem are we going to solve? So the whole company was really innovative. And I think you saw that. I mean, it was people spun out and they continued to take that sort of innovation and solve problems. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if, you know, the only way to create value for a company is to solve a big problem. And the bigger problem you solve, the more value you create. And the storage of value is money. So people give it to you. That was the, and I think that's transferred over to a lot of the folks that left.
And are you still with Find the Best today?
Yep.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Find the Best. We launched coming up on 4 years now. We help about 24 million people a month make, we're the research engine. We help them make major decision, research major decisions, anywhere from, you know, which car to buy, which college to go to, which CRM software. So we cover 2,000 topics. We have over, we have over 700 million things and over 70 billion attributes describing those things. So, you know, we've amassed an enormous amount of information to help people put things in context. So we just, our biggest new launch recently, a couple weeks ago, was Homes. So a competitor to Zillow and Trulia.
Well, and it's about that purchasing intent there, right?
Completely. You know, people, we discovered a lot of interesting stuff about research. One is people want more data. They're worried about missing information and they're willing to spend the time. And the wonderful thing about that, I think the internet is that people were very scared about this. Marketers were horrified about it, is that in the old days, there was this information asymmetry. You know, the marketer knew everything and the consumer knew nothing. Right? It was kind of the gazelle lion. The informed, you know, the consumer is completely informed. You know, for our homes, we tell them everything. We tell them how, you know, what's the neighborhood like? What's the schools like? You know, what's the crime? What's the square footage price compared to other houses in the neighborhood? We tell them everything. And one thing I think marketers have finally discovered, good marketers, is that, you know, an informed consumer is a buying consumer. People don't buy because they're nervous. They're afraid of making a mistake. When they have all the information, they buy. You know, think about when you buy a car or go to college or something. When you have that information, you feel much more confident.
Right, and it's the confidence.
Yes, and then our tagline is research with confidence.
Well, Kevin O'Connor, thank you so much for taking the time.
Appreciate it, Brian. It's not, I don't like to look back in life, so, but it's fun every once in a while. I mean, the internet was. I'm glad you're capturing this. There's a lot of crazy, interesting stuff that went on back then. Long time ago, coming up on 20 years now.
Right, exactly.
Pretty wild.